702.
Befilo is on Twitter
at
Mpakanyane.
And make that hashtag weekend breakfast. Now, Professor Chilidze Marwala is an accomplished scholar with multidisciplinary research interests, which include the theory and application of artificial intelligence, engineering, computer science, finance, social science, and medicine. He's got an extensive track record in human capacity development. He's published 15 books on artificial intelligence, and he is, of course, the Vice Chancellor and Principal of the University of Johannesburg. Prior to that, he was the Deputy Vice Chancellor for Research and Internationalization, as well as the Executive Dean of Engineering and the Built Environment, both at the University of Johannesburg. He was recently appointed the Deputy Chair of the Presidential Commission on the Fourth Industrial Revolution. And now, the Vice Chancellor of UJ is about to release his book on 4IR. It's called Closing the Gap, the Fourth Industrial Revolution in Africa. Good morning and welcome to Breakfast, Professor Chilidze Marwala.
Good morning, Refila, and good morning to your listeners.
It is such a pleasure to have you on the show this morning. I read your book, Closing the Gap, which will be released shortly, very, very soon in October. But I have to say, I have to commend you on such a comprehensive and accessible work of book.
Yeah. You know, I was writing a book. I was reminded of a statement that is attributed to, I think it's Albert Einstein, where he said that if you cannot be able to explain something to your grandmother who probably cannot read or write,
yes,
then you do not understand it. So I wanted the book to be as accessible as possible.
Yeah, and really, really enjoyable to read. Prof, you know, I was reading through and watching a lot of your past interviews, and it must feel like a decade since you welcomed staff and students to the 2020 academic year in UJ. If you could cast an eye back on your own experiences, what in all your years of work equipped you to be able to deal with having to, for instance, salvage the academic year during a global pandemic?
Well, I think the major principle that I adopt is adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
The ability to adapt to situations is actually very, very crucial, you know. And that is exactly what happened at the beginning of the year. We never expected to move online, and we moved online.
Sure.
And we moved online quite smoothly. The irony of it all is that the pass rates this year are higher than the pass rates last year.
Really?
So it means online learning is working quite well.
Mm-hmm.
The class attendance, because we are able to track class attendance, are higher this year than last year.
Mm-hmm.
Again, quite surprising, but when I ask the students, they say, but we are at home. What else can we do? You know? Of course, there were other challenges like access to devices and access to data.
Yes.
Fortunately, at the University of Johannesburg, we have traditionally given devices to our poorest students.
Mm-hmm.
So currently, we have about 25,000 devices that we have distributed to our students. And then we give data to all our students every month so that they can be able to access this.
Yeah.
And because of that, you know, that thinking quickly and adapting to situation, we finished our first semester on time, and we are going to finish the academic year on time.
Mm.
That is actually quite exciting, given the fact that there are other universities that have not been able to make the sort of progress that we have made. So that is due to our ability to adapt to situations.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of the ability to adapt to situations, it seems to me in watching a lot of or reading about you and watching a lot of your interviews is that communication and interpersonal skills is something that you value quite highly, and quite at odds really with, you know, you're someone who is obviously interested in the future of work. I guess some people would call you a futurist, and I guess that characterization is quite at odds with the idea of people who are interested in tech either being actually awkward or not really being a fan of human beings and interaction to the extent that you are. How have you come around to this way, or how have you come around to this way of thinking or viewing the world?
Well, I think I was given good education. I should acknowledge that.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the problems, and we are trying to fix that in South Africa, at the University of Johannesburg, one of the biggest problems with our education system that has largely been copied from England, and it was not even a perfect copy, is that we emphasize too much on specialization too early.
Okay.
So if you look at the British, by the time they do the last 2 years of high school, if they are interested in engineering, if they are interested in science, they are no longer doing languages.
Mm-hmm.
They are no longer doing history. And then in my own experience, when I arrived in high school, all of a sudden I was forced to choose whether I'm going to do the science and drop history, take the history and social science and drop the science.
Yes.
And when I think about it, I should have been allowed to do all those things until I finish my matric. So when I was an undergraduate in the United States, and I had transferred from the University of Cape Town, and I had seen the curriculum of the engineering curriculum of the University of Cape Town, when I arrived in the United States, they said, no, yeah, you're doing engineering, but you have to take 12 courses in human and social sciences.
Mm-hmm.
And 6 of them must be in single discipline. So I went and took 3 acting classes. I was even in a play, My Children, My Africa, as Tamim Bikwana.
Yes.
For a grade, it is reflected in my transcript,
mm-hmm,
of an engineering degree. I went and took 2 psychology classes. Well, now we hear about, in artificial intelligence, you have something called reinforcement learning. How do you make people learn?
Yeah.
And normally, the answer is through punishment and reward. You know, that is the theory of learning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it is very important in the field of artificial intelligence. I tell my colleagues, I actually learn about this in psychology. I did not learn about it in engineering.
Yes.
Very, very important. I took history.
Mm-hmm.
I took economics. I think that is very, very important because we are living in an era where people in computer science are expected to build machines that are able to understand language. How in the world are they going to build such machines if they do not understand linguistics?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're living in an era where machines are supposed to do, to read. You are supposed to use a camera to look at the leaves, mm-hmm, of a plant, and the app is supposed to tell you what plant it is. You know, mm-hmm, how in the world will a computer science be able to achieve that unless they also understand biology? So multidisciplinary educational experience, which I benefited from, mm-hmm, is extremely important.
Yeah. I mean, one of my favorite technology journalists, Kara Swisher, often, you know, would say that had someone like a Mark Zuckerberg, for instance, studied philosophy or even gotten his complete undergrad degree, but of course studied philosophy and or even ethics, perhaps we might not find ourselves in as quite a big social media dilemma with Facebook as the world finds itself, for instance, that multidisciplinary approach could bear us all in such good stead.
Absolutely. Obviously, Mark Zuckerberg was studying computer science and sociology, so So he had quite a bit, multidisciplinary experience. I think for him, it is the question of maximization of that is driving him.
Yeah.
I think he understood very well what is right and what is wrong. Because if you check, this media company such as Facebook, they basically take your data and then they sell it. And then they upfront they give you a contract. You know, whenever you come to Facebook for the first time,
there will be
some long contract, and you are supposed to say yes and then click, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
And these people even go and get psychologists and say, how do we make this contract so unreadable, so that people will read, who are interested to read, they will read first paragraph, they will give up, and they will go and sign it and start reading the rest of it. And I think that is deliberate more than anything else. And
Absolutely.
It is driven by the motive to maximize profit and satisfy the investors.
Mm. And I guess this then naturally drives us to your book, Closing the Gap, The Fourth Industrial Revolution in Africa. It will be available to buy in a couple of weeks. We're lucky to get an early copy. And it really is, like I said, it's fascinating reading. It's really interesting reading. And you admit that even as deputy chair of the Presidential Commission on the Fourth Industrial Revolution, you say that the task at hand isn't an easy one, right? Because you have to assist government in advantage of the Fourth Industrial Revolution. And this is no easy feat, considering there's a fundamental misunderstanding of the Fourth Industrial Revolution. So my question is a three-part question. Can you give us a working definition of 4IR? Because goodness knows, we've heard it thrown around so many times, whether by politicians in parliament or even on media. Can you just break it down for us so that, as the kids say, it stays forever broke?
Yeah, I would say the Fourth Industrial Revolution is an era where machines are becoming intelligent, like human beings, and sometimes more than human beings. And by so doing, make humans, machines, and the environment become one system.
Mm-hmm.
It basically means you are no longer just a human being. You are a human being plus whatever machine that is attached to you all the time. And one example of such a machine would be a phone.
Yes.
You know, if I were to say to you, Refile, please, let me take a phone and lock it into a room, and you will come and get it in 2 weeks' time.
Sure.
I think even in one hour, you would start behaving in a way that is not familiar, simply because you are so attached to this machine called the phone that it has become part of you, even though it is not physically connected. It is certainly psychologically and connected to you, because what do many people do in the morning when they wake?
Yeah, you check your phone. You check your emails, you check your messages, you even check the weather.
Yeah, that is because it has become an integral part of you. So that is really what the Fourth Industrial Revolution is about.
Sure.
And the intelligence of these technologies make these machines even understand you and feed you information that it will think you will like.
Sure.
For example, if you go to Facebook, the information that comes, the postings that come to you are postings that algorithm thinks you would like, simply because it has watched things that you have been watching in the past.
Mm-hmm.
So that is really what the Fourth Industrial Revolution is all about.
So how do you, in your capacity, make parliamentarians who've been on the job for decades understand what it is that we're talking about when we talk about the Fourth Industrial Revolution, and then be able to synthesize that understanding into finding and identifying opportunities? Because we're not all blessed with the same level of interest in technology, or making, you know, being able to find those through lines and those themes in application and opportunity.
Well, I think we need to educate our parliamentarians. I think it's extremely dangerous for any country to have parliamentarians who are not familiar with these technologies. Mm. Because they're supposed to make laws around these technologies. Mm. They're supposed to understand the laws that have to emerge. And there are lots of laws that have to be made. And that is one of our recommendations of the Fourth Industrial Revolution Commission.
Yes.
And literacy, technological literacy, must never be taken for granted. And our parliamentarians are not alone.
Sure.
I'm not too sure whether you saw the video when Mark Zuckerberg went to the American Congress.
Yeah, we followed the hearings, especially around discussions around breaking up big tech. And yes, we are not alone, because they struggled immensely defining or understanding why they were questioning him or how to question him about his company's work.
Absolutely. So we absolutely need to get our parliamentarians understand technologies.
Mm-hmm.
I should have a diverse parliamentarians. If you look at our politicians, they more or less think alike.
Sure.
They more or less think alike. And that is extremely dangerous.
Mm.
Because their job is to make laws that touch on everything from a social grant to how to regulate social media, how to regulate biotechnological products when they come to South Africa, and so on and so forth. So if we do not have a parliamentary system that is constituted by people with diverse skills, then we are going to succeed. In fact, you are going to fail.
Yeah.
If you go to parliament and you don't find experts in technology, then you have a problem.
Mm.
Experts in biology, lawyers, civil servants, that diversity is very, very important.
Absolutely.
But we have the politicians that we have. What can we do about them? I think we need to educate them. I have spent quite a great deal of time in our own parliament talking about science. Now, I was invited by the ANC caucus to come and talk about technology. I was also invited by the DA policy unit to also come and talk about technology, and I'm hoping to go and talk about to the EFF, to the IFP, so that we can actually be educated in this very, very, very important development. That if we do not grasp, especially from our parliament, we are going to become victims of the Fourth Industrial Revolution, and we know the consequences of that are going to be. Going to be poverty, inequality, unemployment, and ultimately underdevelopment.
Before we talk about the opportunities of the Fourth Industrial Revolution and the conversation that we constantly have around the possibility or the ability to utilize it to leapfrog from our current situation, let's then get to the third tier of that discussion, or that third tier of the question around technology and understanding technology, which is, how do we have these same conversations? We've moved from parliamentarians now. How do we have these same conversations amongst ordinary South Africans? And I think listeners will be familiar with this question, because I always think that it cannot end with people that, you know, specialize in technology and talk about the processing power of my iPhone, for instance. But as citizens, we should be talking about technology in a way, in a nuanced way, in a way that shows our understanding of technology around the world as well, for instance, right? Why aren't we talking about net neutrality as it's, you know, being unbundled in the United States? And if it has any bearing on us here in South Africa, should we, for instance, also be discussing the internet as a public utility, the same way we expect water and light to be that?
Well, absolutely, absolutely. I think South Africa actually has mechanisms into place to diffuse technology to the rest of society.
Okay.
For example, we have an agency called the South African Agency for Science and Technology Advancement.
Mm-hmm.
And one of its mandates is public understanding of science and technology. Very, very important. You know? Now, the question is it adequately funded so that it can be do the sort of work that it's supposed to do?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not, but it can do more, you know. How much of it are we seeing on SABC radio and television? Because that is another media that we can be able to use to educate our people, you know. And is it also talking about some of the latest developments that are coming on? You know, like for example, not too long ago, we read about the copying of a ship called Dolly. I mean, the idea of copying someone basically mm-hmm. means that you can produce a child by using by just copying the cells of one of the parents. All these things are happening right in front of our eyes, and our people are not even part of the conversation.
Yeah.
So let us use existing institutions. Let us reimagine the concept of adult-based education.
Mm-hmm.
We tended to think of adult-based education as an education that is intended to make adults who are not literate to become literate. Unfortunately, the illiteracy of the 21st century is not going to be the inability to read and write, you know.
Yes.
It is actually going to be the inability to understand technology.
Mm-hmm.
Who even use technology, very, very important.
Absolutely.
So technological literacy, science literacy is becoming very, very important for the modern state. And we have to use our infrastructure, our school system, schooling system must be used in the afternoons to teach communities on the matters of technology, to show people videos on development, and we must have people who are there as tutors, as teachers, to explain these developments in local languages, especially for the people who do not understand English. So I think that is what we have to do.
All right. If you've just joined us, let me take the time to introduce my guest. My profile guest is Professor Chilidze Marwala, Professor of Art Intelligence and Vice Chancellor at University of Johannesburg. We're going to take a short break and hear what's happening in the world of sports. But when we come back from that, we're going to carry on our discussion with Professor Marwala. And I'm going to ask him about the opportunities that technology presents us with and explore the promise of leapfrogging from our current situation, perhaps into better conditions, right? How will we be able to bear this out as a country? Do we have the wherewithal, the political will, the science to do so? So let's carry on the conversation.
702, call Refilwe
on 011-883-0702.
It's 8:36 on the Sunday edition of Weekend Breakfast. If you've just tuned in, you're right on time for the second part of my profile interview with Professor Chilidze Marwala, who's Professor of Artificial Intelligence and Vice Chancellor at the University of Johannesburg. Now, the professor's published 14 books on artificial intelligence. One of them has been translated into Mandarin. Published over 300 papers in journals, proceedings, book chapters and magazines, and I'm told he holds 4 of patents. And, you know, what's really, really exciting in his long, long list of achievements is the book that he's written called Closing the Gap, The Fourth Industrial Revolution in Africa. It's published by Pan Macmillan and it will be out in October. But I really had such fun reading it yesterday and just getting a concise and clear sort of succinct look into what it is that and how it is that we're thinking about technology here in South Africa. And I say this, of course, because he is a deputy chair of the Presidential Commission on the Fourth Industrial Revolution. So who better than the professor to give us insight into where our thinking is as a country when it comes to tech. Professor, thank you so much for your time once again this morning. As we continue our conversation, one thing that I'm so abidingly interested in is, you know, the sort of utopian ideals that or thoughts that we have around technology and what it can do for us, especially as a developing economy or developing nation. Are we sort of overselling the idea that tech can help us leapfrog a lot of our developmental shortcomings?
No, absolutely not. I don't think the problem of poverty is going to be solved without technology.
Sure.
I just take agriculture, for example. You know, how do we increase the yield without having to think about even some of the most controversial subjects, such as genetically modified seeds, mm-hmm. GMOs. Mm-hmm. And what is the implication of that? Are they safe? Are they not safe? You know, mm-hmm. Are they even in our food that we are already eating? You know, and what is the implication of that? But it is clear that technology of genetics, you can actually be able to have seed that will give you a plant that are immune to drought and other factors. That can actually affect your production. Mm-hmm. If you look at issues of jobs, one of the things that we have not really done well as the African continent is to industrialize. And industrialization has been a huge source of employment in Asia, for example, in Europe in the previous century, but it was never here. How do you reduce our unemployment rate from 30% to 8% without some form of industrialization?
Mm-hmm.
We know that everything that we consume, especially technologically, is not from here. Whether it is our phones, whether it is our sometimes even our cars are not even made here in South Africa. You know, in fact, South Africa does not have a homegrown car company.
Sure.
So, how do we bring those things here so that we can tackle the problem of unemployment?
Sure.
So I think it is quite key. And if we do not get that the way forward, there is no other way forward without technology. Anything else, then we might as well prepare ourselves for the Bronze Age.
I guess what it then means is that back to the point of understanding or technological literacy and education is understanding the capabilities and the opportunities that the fourth industrial revolution presents, right? That artificial intelligence presents, as opposed to worrying about jobs lost. It's the type of jobs that might be lost or will no longer be around that we need to move on from at any rate.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I try to do in this book is to talk about some of the industries that are going to be impacted by this technology. I give an example of a language. Google has an application called Google Translate.
Mm-hmm.
You can go to Google and you are able to put words in isiZulu and then translate to English. It turns out that system does not work very well. And the reason why it does not work very well is because the people who created it are not isiZulu speakers.
Sure.
Is there no possibility for us to be able to create our own system and sell it?
Mm-hmm.
Because it is really about us. You know, doesn't it sound odd that something that is a translator between isiZulu and English, for example, comes from Silicon Valley, not from Wamashu, for example? You know,
absolutely.
And what we need to do, what we need to put into place to make sure that we have an environment where young entrepreneurs will be able to sufficiently understand technology to go and make these products that our people need.
Well, to that point,
the technologies of the future, when it comes to language, we are going to have things in our ears which are going to listen to languages, all sorts of languages, and translate for us immediately.
Mm.
Are we going to just spectate when our languages are being processed and not participate? Mm. And can it really be accurate if we are not there in the first place.
Absolutely. So to that point, you tackle the issue, the matter of digital heritage in your book. What do you mean when you talk about that?
I mean, I talk about issues of our data. So you have companies that are collecting data around our languages, which is our heritage, obviously,
sure,
and put it into an algorithm to form speech translator, language translators. We talk about even our biological data.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we take a community in Limpopo and we do a genome of it, analyze it, and then put it in some algorithm so that in the hopefully in the future that data can be part of some system that will be used to diagnose diseases. You know,
mm-hmm.
The data is from us; it's part of our heritage. But the technological devices that are created using that data is not from us. What do we do about it? We need to impose regulation around it.
Mm-hmm.
The European Union is imposing regulations around that, you know.
Yeah.
So that is really what I mean.
Sure. Do you think that quite often we get left behind or we're slow out of the blocks when it comes to data security and data privacy? You've mentioned the European Union legislating quite aggressively in that sector and in that field. Obviously, with the understanding that, yes, of course, their digital heritage is at stake should they continue to sleep on the job. But also the fact that, you know, if you're going to be storing, like you said, you're going to sequence the genomes, for instance, of a certain community, but how in the world does that data then get taken and stored in another country or in a different continent altogether? Do you think that we are slow out of the blocks because we're busy addressing bread and butter issues, not understanding that, as you said, in the future, digital heritage will be a bread and butter issue, or in fact is, we just aren't awake to that fact yet?
Absolutely, we are certainly not where we are supposed to be, and there are a number of reasons why that is the case. Firstly, collectively, we do not understand these technologies.
Okay.
You know, how many people in South Africa collectively understand these technologies? And if we don't understand these technologies, there's no way we are going to be at the forefront of them.
Sure.
So in many ways, we are being left behind. And sometimes when this data, because we don't understand this, we don't even know how to regulate this data. Now we are told, for example, that data is the new oil.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and just think about that. Data is the new oil because you can sell it just like oil. And now you have a company like Twitter or even Facebook that is mining that oil. I don't know how much data they collect every day, but from South Africa. But it's a huge amount of data. And they collect it not because they just want to go and store it and look at it, you know. They collect it because they want to sell that data, to sell it to, such data being used, being sold by Cambridge Analytica.
Sure.
To win elections, presidential elections in the United States. And we don't even know how much data is being collected. We don't even tax that data that is being collected. Now, if it is oil, we would probably know how much it is being drilled, mm-hmm. and we'll probably tax it. Can't we change the mindset so that we can also be able to treat data, which is an economic commodity, just like any other economic commodity, such as oil, such as gold, such as diamond, and so on and so forth. And that will obviously require a mindset shift, the understanding of things that we have not conventionally understood. We have not been able to understand it.
Prof, we've got a question from Phil in Waterkloof who'd like to pose a question to you. Welcome to the show, Phil. You can go ahead and speak to the professor.
Hi, good morning, Sister Phil, and good morning to my favorite prof. I think I was introduced to you by Professor Vili Nkomo, who was my neighbor. who instilled this thing of multidisciplinary passing in me. The issue of the how the businesses must create and capture value is dependent on the five technologies that are affecting the very foundation of the global businesses. We talk about the cloud and mobile computing, the big data and machine learning, the sensors and intelligent manufacturing,
sure,
advanced robotics and drones and clean energy technologies. But we have seen that in the history of growth, the growth and advancement of civilization may be divided into three eras: the agrarian revolution, the industrial revolution, and the digital revolution. Now, workplaces and businesses must take into account that the technology by its nature is a job killer. They must adjust and adapt to the technological challenges and understand that the future in the digital world, the future generation will it is important to be understood. They need to understand.
Are you asking, Phil, how businesses can do this? Are you asking how businesses can adapt?
The businesses must adapt by understanding that the future generation, that I call them the Generation X, they need to be understood how they need to be. They are independent, they are resourceful, self-sufficient, they value freedom and responsibility in the workplace. And in many generations, they disdain casual disdain for authority and structured working hours. So they should be allowed to implement the four C's that I call them: the communication, creativity.
Do you have a question for the professor, Phil?
I was just reading.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, sir. Really appreciate it. Phil, very excited to speak to you. Obviously, there, Professor. And yeah, essentially concurring with you that we need to ready ourselves as a country if we're going to be up for the challenge of and the opportunity of the fourth industrial revolution.
Absolutely. I agree with Phil. He's correct. All of us have to adapt.
Yeah.
Whether this we are companies, whether we are society, whether we are individuals, all of us have to adapt.
You know, Professor, just this past Thursday, St. John's College presented you with the 2020 Golden Eagle Award. You're one of two Old Johanians that they presented this to. But essentially, it was an award that is given to people who are dedicated and have devoted a considerable part of their lives in service to humanity and improving the world in an exceptional, they say, and dedicated and selfless manner. Do you view your actions in the same light, or for you, is it just common sense? Is this just what a human being in your position with your capacity and your status does? Because I've heard you often talking about the multiplier effect that you rely on in your own work and which is passing on your knowledge, mentoring, but also making sure that those that have experienced the benefit of this service of yours do the same for others.
Well, I actually think it is both. I think the first aspect is that I actually like that. I love technology. I love science. When I was in high school at Ndiri in Venda, I won the Science Olympiad, and I spent two weeks in England. Mm-hmm. It just opened my mind to science. So, firstly, I love science. Secondly, I would like to share my love for science with other people.
Yeah.
So as a result, I spent a lot of time supervising masters and doctoral students, you know, and we love it. Obviously,
I think at last count, was it 47 master students and 28 doctoral students supervising them to completion?
So, yeah, absolutely. And some of them, I mean, I was talking to one of one who is at NASA in the United States from Soweto. That whole thing where you have somebody, they don't really know much about technology, and all of a sudden they are famous people based in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
That transformation to me is very fascinating. And I think it is important for us as a progressive society to get as many people who are passionate about training the next generation of people to become better. It does not have to be in science and technology. It can be in business.
Mm-hmm.
It can be in languages. It can be in diplomacy. All
yes.
areas of our lives, we need to have mentors, people who can be able to hold the next generation by the hand so that they can be able to go on forth and make a difference in society.
And finally, Prof, you know, you talk a lot as well about progressive societies. So what in your definition, in your view, is a progressive society?
I think a progressive society is a society that is, the future is always better than the past. You know, whether it is in terms of our economy, our future economy must certainly be better than our past economy. Our unemployment rates in the future must be better than unemployment rates in the past.
Yeah.
Our poverty levels must be lower in the future than in the past. For me, that is what a progressive society is. But for that to happen, there has to be a lot of work that needs to be done. And it can't be done by few individuals. It has to be done by as many individuals as possible. And that is really the role of the progressive forces, the people, our teachers, our businessmen, our entrepreneurs,
sure.
who are supposed to put mechanisms into place so that the future looks better than the past.
So, on a final note, Prof, you do this on a campus-wide scale, which is exactly that, to set the tone, to create an overarching sort of theme or context within which your students operate. And how do you embark on a societal, project in which you start to create the sort of environment, the sort of thinking that or outlook and sentiment that you've just alluded to? It sounds like a mammoth task, but obviously one that must happen.
Well, I suppose writing a book is one of them, so people can go and buy the book.
Mm-hmm.
But also, many things that I do on my campus, I also do outside. For
yeah.
example, one of the things that worries me is that people are not reading. Our people are not reading. So I have a reading club where I invite staff, students at the University of Johannesburg, and any member of our community outside, because you can be able to get online, can come and participate and hopefully read the book before you come and participate.
Sure.
And so many of the things that we do, we also expand them to people who are outside our campuses.
Yeah.
But obviously, if you are inside the campus, one of our four campuses, then you're obviously going to benefit the most because you probably will have access to what I am doing much, much more effectively than when you're outside.
Mm, absolutely. Professor Chilidze Madwala, thank you so much for your time this morning, for your insights and your passion and energy. We really do appreciate it. And I think we're all the better for having spent this hour with you.
Well, thank you very much, Ifile.
An absolute pleasure, Prof. You keep well. And of course, the book is called Closing the Gap, The Fourth Industrial Revolution in Africa. Professor Chilidze Madwala is a professor of artificial intelligence and the vice chancellor at the University of Johannesburg.